Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Alex from Bel Air, Maryland.
My name is Alex Browning. I'm an alcoholic. Pleasure to be here. I think my main goal tonight is to be honest about my experience. And I can tell you right now, it's not my favorite thing to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, to stand up at a podium and speak for an hour. But I can tell you really that it's something I appreciate. I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to share my experience, because I believe it's really powerful. It completely transformed my life inside and out, you know, physical, mental, spiritually, emotionally, everything. The way I completely see the world, it changed because of God, because of AA, because of the experience that I had. And like I said, I'm an alcoholic. I believe that it means something different to me now than it did in the past, every other time I had tried to get sober, because it had been a few different times. I'm originally from Alexandria, Virginia. I live in Bel Air, Maryland now. It's a little bit north of Baltimore. But in Virginia, when you get in trouble, when you get arrested, they send you to IOPs and classes. They don't send you to AA. So it took a little bit for me to make it to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had a lot of different experiences and IOPs, classes. They have this thing called the Alcohol Safety Action Program. And I'll be honest, I can't really tell you much of what they said. I didn't really want to listen. I didn't believe I needed to stop drinking for a really long time. Again, I'm an alcoholic. A drink does something so special for me, and it doesn't matter, a drink, drugs, everything. To me, I don't believe that it's a different disease. I don't believe it's a different problem. To me, it's all the same thing. It all did the same thing for me. It gave me freedom for myself. And at the same time, on the other hand, I could never control. Any time I drank, any time I did drugs, whatever, I lost control. And eventually, when it got to the point where I didn't want to do it anymore and I wanted a different life, I found that I couldn't find one. I couldn't stop, even when I had every single consequence telling me that I should. So I'll start from the beginning, or anything that's really relevant. I'm from Alexandria, Virginia. Nobody in my immediate family is an alcoholic. Not that that's even necessarily relevant, but I didn't grow up in that home. I guess every family has some sort of dysfunction. Mine certainly did. My parents argued a lot with me, my sister. My sister was always the problem child, and I kind of just skated by. I only have one older sister. That's it. I have one uncle who's an alcoholic. And that's it. And he, unfortunately, to this day is not sober. And all I can really do is pray for the guy. I love him a lot. He was like, he's such a charismatic guy. Such a great guy to be around. And I know a lot of alcoholics like that. Like one of my best friends, who was the first person I was real close to who died from this disease, was one of those people. Such an attractive personality. Everybody loved to be around this guy. And what I know about myself today is like, I wasn't that guy. I was the opposite. And my dad always said this to me. He said that the people you hang around are undesirables. And he couldn't really see the truth that that was me. I was the undesirable individual. I was the bad influence. And nobody wanted to be around me. They called me a lingerer. And all I ever wanted to do, I just wanted to fit in. I just wanted to be accepted by other people. And that characterized my youth. And as a result of that mentality, that state of mind, that thinking, I didn't care about other people. And it wasn't like when I made decisions about myself, like this is going to make me feel good, this is going to benefit me. It wasn't like, oh, forget about you. I couldn't see past this. I could not put you into consideration. It doesn't matter if you're a good friend, anybody, a random individual, my mother, my sister, it didn't matter. I couldn't put them into consideration. Even if I wanted to, I was incapable of doing that. I was incapable of caring or loving for somebody else. And that was as a child growing up, and I didn't know it. And I didn't know that my entire life until I got here and somebody told me about myself when they were talking about themselves, and I could relate. And that's like what we call the language of the heart. I had a long conversation on the drive up here. It's like, now I got to talk for another hour. I feel almost winded, you know, not necessarily winded, but my throat hurts. I've been talking for a little bit, but I could talk for hours about myself, just a little bit selfish. But hey, it was a beautiful drive up here. I was telling the guys, I was in Doylestown on Saturday night to go with my buddy to speak, and it was a beautiful drive, just like the drive tonight. Beautiful. I was excited about it. I was just excited for the trip. I love road trips in general. I love going to hear our speakers. My home group, the Primary Purpose Speakers Group, Bel Air, we're a speaker meeting. Our format's a little different. We have a 10-minute speaker who speaks solely on the primary purpose, and then a 45-minute main speaker. And try and provide a consistent message. Hope and recovery through the 12 steps, God reliance, service to others. That's what we're about over there. And I love hearing anybody who has anything to say about that. The steps as they're outlined in the big book. That's my sponsor. That's how I got sober, how I was taken through the steps through the big book. And I have a passion for it. It was something that was just so attractive to me. And it never was like before this time around. You know, and I had been to AA before this time around. Like I said, I've been to the IOPs, I had been to the classes, and just for the longest time, I couldn't see myself sober. I didn't even think people got sober. Like the people I ran with, the people I drank with, it's just like, okay, oh, they're going to get sober. They got in some trouble. Like they'll be back. Like they'll be back. I'll see you soon. Like maybe I'm not hanging out with you now. It's somebody else. And I just, like, I didn't believe it. It just wasn't something realistic to me. I can tell you the first time I took a drink with my buddies in the basement at my parents' house, drinking vermouth, and it was a great time, to say the least. But what I really realized at that point in time was that drinking was going to be a part of my life for the rest of my life. And my parents, they partied, they drank socially, whatever. They're not alcoholics, but they made drinking look attractive, certainly. They hung out with a lot of people. And I just knew. I was like, this is going to be a part of my life, no matter what. And that proved to be the truth. Like, throughout high school, I started drinking more often, going to parties on the weekend. Until, like, I was, like, a senior in high school, drinking every day, had been arrested a few times, trespassing, drinking, possession of whatever, different stuff. And I community service, IOPs, classes. And, like, as a teenager, it's really just like, okay, let me finish my probation, complete my community service, get back in school, get my grades together, make everything look great. I'll go to college. You know, my parents expected me to go to college. I expected myself to go. I believed I was going to be successful in my life no matter what. Like, it just was going to happen for me. I didn't know what working for something actually looked like. I really had no work ethic my entire life. I wasn't driven to do anything other than drink and feel good. That was about it. That was all I pursued. That was all I had a passion for as soon as I did it. And I lost hope somewhere along those lines. And when I did it, nothing else really mattered. The charges always got worse. And even when, like, the consequences continued to get worse, like, I still had a great time. Like, it was really easy for me to, like, forget about that stuff and kind of put it to the side and just be like, figure, I got a plan. This is what's going to make everything better. This is what's going to make everything look all right. I just got to get through it, and that's it. It could be worse, right? And I guess it could always be worse. I couldn't be standing here right now. And I'll just say this. The fact that I'm even standing here right now is a miracle, let alone like blessings I've had in my life, spiritual experiences I've had that have changed my life for the better. Just the fact that I'm standing here in the first place is a miracle. I don't have a good reason for it. I don't. And I can elaborate on that more. All I really know, the truth, is that I'm standing here with the opportunity to help somebody else who probably shouldn't be here either. Excuse me. That's nice. So, like, miracles, purpose, God. I grew up Jewish. My dad, he was a Methodist. My mom was Jewish. I was raised Jewish. And so, as a kid growing up, I was made fun of all the time, you know, pretty much my whole life. And it kind of pushed me away from the religious aspect. I didn't really want anything to do with religion, not mine, not anybody else's. But I always believed there was a God. And I don't want to say always. What I had an experience where I was like, God's real. I was a child, probably 6, maybe 8 years old. I was young. And I was in a boutique with my mom, I believe. And I remember being at this gumball machine and I was like, God, if you're real, let me get a blue gumball. You know, like an 8 year old questioning the existence of God. But that's what I said. And I got a blue gumball. But of course, like, that's not good enough. Alcoholic. I was like, God, if I get another blue gumball, like, you're real. And I got another one. And then I put another quarter in and got a third one. And I was like, okay, because I was still questioning at that point. I got 3 blue gumballs from this machine and was sold on the existence of a God. Again, I didn't want to follow any sort of, like, religious principles. I just believed God was there to answer my prayers. And I prayed for a lot of stuff, like this girl to come into my life. Or I remember one time, again, as a child, I flooded my mom's toilet and I was praying for God to, like, fix it. Like, not, you know, and the toilet wouldn't stop flooding. Moral of the story, if God ever answered my prayers, I don't think I can recall. And if he did, it wasn't good enough. It just wasn't. It was on to the next one. What else do I need from you? God forbid praying for somebody else. And that's kind of like what happened to me when I first read the big book. It talks about it a little bit in Bill's story, praying for other people and God's will, and then maybe it'll come true. And a guy told me to read the big book, and that was like the main thing that popped out to me. I didn't read the whole big book. I probably read like 15 pages. But that was all I really needed to have some experience. So, I mean, I was in and out for a little bit. I came to AA the first time. The first time I was at an inpatient treatment center, I was 20 years old. I had just gotten out of jail for the worst charges I had gotten. I had gotten felony charges, gotten out of jail. And I was like, I was willing to be sober. While I was in jail, I was saying, like, I'll go to an inpatient treatment center this time. Because they had tried to get me before. Master manipulator. I can always find a way around something that I don't want to do pretty well for the most part. And I never went to a treatment center. Just IOPs, the classes. And I just made it seem like it wasn't as bad as it really was. And I went to this treatment center and they brought me to AA for the first time. And I felt like hope. I felt like AA unity. We talk about unity and people were talking about helping, like, we help each other stay sober. That's really what I heard, is like, we help each other stay sober. And I, like, took that very literally. Like, I remember when I wanted to drink one day, I called my sponsor and I had told him. I was 30 days. I got out of treatment center, took their recommendation to move to an Oxford house, which is like a halfway house in Virginia. In Maryland, we don't really have much of those. It's recovery houses, halfway houses, whatever you want to call them. But the Oxford house is a little bit more independent. It's, we hold each other accountable is kind of how that works. And I didn't hold anybody accountable and nobody was really able to hold me accountable there. I wasn't sober for 8 of the 9 months I lived there. And I got away with it pretty well. But I came to AA and they were talking about, we help each other stay sober. They said, if you want a drink, call your sponsor. And I did that. I called him. I told him, I was like, I really want to have a drink. I want to get loaded. And he said, who knows what he said. He called his sponsor, though. And he put him on the phone. I listened to, like, whatever they were saying. And after I hung up the phone, I was like, I'm still going to do it. And the truth of the matter is, I was going to do it regardless. And at that point in my life, at that experience I had in Alcoholics Anonymous, nobody came up to me and said, you know, you're suffering from a disease that's going to kill you. You need to have a spiritual experience and an entire psychic change. Otherwise, you're going to drink again and die. Like, nobody said that to me. You need to have a spiritual awakening as quick as possible. Or else you're doomed. You will drink again. And I guess that doesn't happen all the time. But that's the kind of consistent message I like to talk about. Because that's the truth about my experience. I got the charges. They got worse. I was in jail. I was talking about my best friend earlier, a close friend of mine. We were friends for like 10 years and drinking every day together. We went to jail. I went to jail. We were in the ASAP classes, Alcohol Safety Action Program. We were in the classes together. I remember one time we were there and we were both loaded, and a girl came up to us afterwards and said, "Hey, you want to come to a meeting after this?" And we were like, "Ooh, like a meeting, it sounded good." She was really hot. That's why it sounded good. But like, she wanted to go that night and we had plans. The next day I went to jail. His 20th birthday was like a week later. And the thing about my circumstances when I went to jail is, at first it was a $10,000 bond. And that pretty much means you could pay $1,000 and get me out of jail. I mean, that's kind of steep for like anybody I was hanging out with to pay. And my family at this point was done with me. They didn't want any more of my stuff. And I just had to sit there. I sat there for a week, and they reduced it to $2,500. $250, come get me out of jail. Nobody I was friends with, nobody I could call my friend at that point in time, was willing to pay $250. And they might have been if I convinced them well enough, but the truth is that really nobody was willing to sign that piece of paper. Nobody was willing to vouch for me to do what I had to do. And I was in jail for 2.5, 3 months. And while I was there, it was a week before Thanksgiving, my dad came to visit me and he told me Bobby died. And that was all he said. And I didn't really say anything for a few minutes. I was kind of shocked, and a few things went through my head. Really, that I was such a poor influence on this guy, and I knew exactly what had happened to him. I knew why he wasn't with us anymore. And I felt bad, you know, I felt guilty. And what I really felt, though, was why Bobby and not me? I did everything he did, but worse. You know, I could describe myself as a scummier person, not saying like we both didn't do dirtbag things. It's not that we both weren't undesirable to a degree, but the way I screwed people over wasn't good. And I don't think he really did that to the extent that I did. Moreover than that, I talked about Bobby's charismatic personality. Everybody loved Bobby. Everybody was his friend. They liked Bobby. Nobody liked me, and I always just felt like everybody was talking bad about me. They were judging me, hypocritical, exclusive. And I say that now. I said that about a lot of people. I remember writing my first inventory, and that was like my major resentment against a couple hundred people. Literally. But I found out the truth was that was me. I was fake. I didn't care about people. I was hypocritical, judgmental. You know, I knew who you were before I met you. That's just how I carried it. That's how I treated other people. And I couldn't see that. I couldn't see the truth. But Bobby died. I was convinced that I was going to stay sober. I'm going to get out of here, and I'm going to do the right thing for once in my life. And I get out of jail a week before Christmas, a couple days before Christmas, 2014, and I drank at a Christmas party. And I got loaded that next weekend, and pretty much for the next month, it was a party. It was hard to have a good time that month. You know, drinking definitely provided me a lot of relief. It did what it was supposed to do, but I couldn't really enjoy it how I wanted to, with all the fear that was in my life about everything going on. And I went to, they let me out of jail, let me say this, on a personal recognizance bond. That's the only way I could get out, is they let me out for free and let me sign for myself in order to go to treatment. And I went a month later. They didn't make me go bed to bed. I went to treatment a month later after getting loaded again when I said I wasn't going to. And I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the rehab I was at was like this. It was just like where I came from. It was like a detention center. Everybody had charges they were going to, coming from prison, were facing probably a lot more time than me, had a lot of experience dealing with that. And it's not to say like people in there, it's not to say that they didn't want to get sober, but they'd been doing the same thing so long they didn't have any idea of another way of life. And I do believe a lot of those people in there want it. But it's so rare when it actually happens. And not to say it's not like that anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I see a lot of people come in here and they want a new way of life the same way I did, the same way so many people I know did, but who wants to actually do this stuff? I can tell you, I never wanted to write an inventory and look at my grosser handicaps. I didn't want to look at any of the wrongdoings I had done. I didn't want to look at my part, and I certainly didn't want to tell anybody I was wrong. And then there were those handful of things, you know, I'm not telling you that either. That was like a big one when I first like saw steps and people talked about fourth and fifth step. I'm like, well, I'll do it, but not the way it's supposed to be done. And I was in AA, I was in the Oxford House, I was going to the PHP classes for the rehab after I had gotten out. I had experienced a little bit of hope. I was happy to be sober. We had the AA meetings. They would take us to outside meetings from the rehab because they brought in meetings pretty much every night. Guys would come from AA, out of their free time, and speak at the rehab, but they would take us out too. And I was the first one to line up at the front door, ready to hop in the van. There were 60 guys in there. You know, a lot of them didn't even want to go. Probably like a third of the guys just wanted to stay in, watch TV, and hang out. And then there was probably like 40 of us who were, we really wanted to go. And it wasn't because we wanted to go hear like a consistent message of hope and recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. We wanted to see the girls from the other side of the rehab. Not the other side, I mean the women's house. They didn't keep them with us. But that's who we really wanted to see. And I remember sitting in those meetings, like I would look at her and I'd be like, that's who I'm going to go talk to immediately after the meeting. Beeline, figure out where you're from, what's going on, what figured out the number to the girls' rehab. And like that was where my head was at. Not to say that I didn't want anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous or be sober, but like my priorities were skewed. It was like, what's going to make Alex happy? And it doesn't look like writing an inventory, trusting God, helping other people, making amends to everybody I've harmed. It just doesn't look like that. That seems counterproductive to me, to my well-being, to give freely of myself for somebody else. It doesn't make sense in my mind. It's because I'm naturally selfish and self-centered, and I'm driven by fear, self-seeking, self-delusion, all these things we talk about. It's like I'm literally driven by these things, and I can't see the truth about it. I'm so scared that I'm just not going to get where I think I need to be in life. And that's kind of just like this whole, the center of my mentality was literally, I believe the world is trying to get over on me, and I have to get mine in this life in order to be happy, in order to be okay. That's how it has to go down. And I'll, without caring about another soul, I'll do whatever I have to do to be okay, to be content, just for a few minutes. And that's really the center of my problem, is that I'm so selfish and self-centered that I can't actually connect to another human being's soul. I can't care about somebody else. It's in that position, I'm just so lonely and uncomfortable that I can't stay sober. No matter how bad anything's ever gotten for me, the felonies, the threat of going into prison, you know, the disappointment of like the people I love, withdrawals, just feeling bad of how much I consume, whatever, just feeling physically sick, anything. Any consequence I had ever experienced, any time I had just felt so poorly about myself and everything that I had done, it just didn't matter. It was always either screw it, it'll be different this time, and here's how. You know, I'm older now, I'm more mature, I'll be able to handle it better. Or it's just like, the last one that got me was just one more so I can get it out of my system, just feel that relief. I'll get back sober again, get my life together, get these felonies taken care of, complete my probation, do what I have to do. I just need to get the one more, and I'll get sober again right after. And I didn't understand what alcoholism is. I didn't realize that I can't just do one and get right back sober. And I don't know if it's because I'd never actually tried to do that specifically, or I was just so engulfed in this delusion of what I believed my life was. But I did it. I was about 50 days sober, something like that, living in the Oxford House. And it was just one day. I was happy to be sober one day, and the next, nothing was good enough. I just had to do it, and it would be okay. I figured out again. Long story short, I went the next year. Didn't die. Didn't go back to jail. It was a success. I pulled it off for that whole year. And what happened is it crumbled down. The probation officer caught me. He didn't send me back to jail. And prior to this, let me tell you, for this whole year after I had gotten out of jail, gotten out of treatment, been in this house, whatever, I hadn't pled guilty to these charges. I hadn't taken a plea deal. I didn't have a lawyer. I had a public defender. I didn't have any money. I didn't have a dime to my name, and my parents weren't going to pay for a lawyer for me. And what I believed I was going to do was take this to trial and win with a public defender. Meanwhile, they had executed a search warrant at my father's home and found all the evidence they needed. They found the old fake prescriptions I had. They found the guy's ID I stole to use to get it, who got arrested, which is the reason they were there in the first place. And I ended up owing that guy a lot of money because he had to get a lawyer, get his charges expunged, and the whole nine. But they had it all there. They had everything they needed. Again, this delusion. I believed I was going to come out on top. And so I didn't plead guilty to these charges for a year and a half. The truth is that I wasn't really willing to accept responsibility for my own actions. You know, the story of my life. I had never really been able to do that. I was very good at pointing the finger at somebody else. It was always someone else's fault for why my life wasn't the way it was supposed to be, why things didn't happen how they should have. And the probation officer gets me. He knows I'm drinking. He knows I'm getting loaded. He doesn't violate me right away. He has me come see him twice a week instead of every 2 weeks, at the courthouse instead of at the satellite building, wherever it was, closer to my house. And I see this guy every day for a month and a half. And he just tells me, he's like, yeah, you need to get sober. You need to take some classes, IOPs. You know, the story of Virginia, you need to go to IOP again. You need to show the courts you're trying to do something to get sober. I was just like, okay. Like, yeah, I gotcha. And I don't think he believed I was going to get sober, because a month and a half later I did get violated. But just prior to that, I had went to him and I said, the only way that I'll possibly get sober is if I go back to inpatient treatment. I can't do it. You know, I tried 2 days here, 1 day here, 2 days here for a month and a half. And every single day I would try and I couldn't do it. And I've been telling myself for that whole year pretty much, like, okay, by my birthday, like, I'll have 30 days sober. And I had so many old ideas just about Alcoholics Anonymous and what it was. And I put so much value on the time that people had been sober for. Like, I really did. I didn't have any grasp of spiritual principles, like spiritual action, the way people live their lives. I didn't really care anything about that. I thought, like, I'll get sober and then my life will get better. Like, that's just what I believed. I didn't know any better. I didn't really pay attention before to, like, what happened to me when I was sober. And I did nothing and my life got worse. I had no realization of that. I didn't really ask anybody for help. I said I asked the guy to sponsor me, and we did nothing. We did nothing together. I remember he, like, bought me some food one time. And I didn't know what to look for in a sponsor. The guy I asked to sponsor me was in rehab with me when I went back a year later. And that's a whole story. I'm not even going to tell it, but when I saw him, it was ridiculous, to say the least. And I remember, like, a few days before I ended up going back to this treatment center, I was at my mom's apartment. I was staying there after I got kicked out of the Oxford house. I came home one morning to the Oxford house. They finally kicked me out after everything I had put them through. And it was a lot, man. I came home one day at like 8 a.m. and there was a new guy. There was a new guy in the house. And we pull up in the car. I take a blast, go inside, and I proceed to explain to this guy how the house works and how everything goes down. And right after that, I knocked on the other guy's door to bum some Newports. And I went in my room. I don't know what happened after that. Like, they came and knocked on the door. They said, "You got to go." I said, "Give me a drug test. Give me a breathalyzer. Anything. Like, I'm good." And they're like, "No, like, you have 45 minutes to pack your things or we're calling the police." And I called my mom and she came and got me. And that's how I ended up there. But I was saying, I was in her apartment one night, a few days before I went, maybe a day or two. I don't remember exactly, but I remember looking at myself in the mirror, fully loaded. And it was every time. I don't want to say I never didn't get relief from the drink, because I did. Every single time it worked. But I just remember looking at myself, and I guess it was that moment of clarity where everything negative in my life that I had experienced, all the consequences, all the negative feelings, the fear, the distrust, just everything compacted. And it just made sense to me. It wasn't worth it. The relief I was still getting was not worth the consequences. And I wish I could tell you, like, that was enough. Like, I just did that, and then I got sober, and I'm here today, and, like, I had to do nothing. But that's just not the truth. It just had that impact on me. Like, I can't keep doing the same thing that I've been doing for the past however many years. I can't. So I go back to treatment. I had the same counselor I had before. I went to the same treatment center. And I loved it. It was like the break from reality I needed. Like, I just love that place. I don't know why. I probably had the best time in rehab anybody could have. I had a good time in jail too. I went to the kitchen. I worked in the kitchen. My buddy I knew from back home worked on the deputy line where they got good food. So I worked in the kitchen. I ate good while everybody had like fake chicken patties. And I went back to this treatment center and I just did degenerate things. I mean, I didn't do anything productive for my sobriety or recovery or anything like that. I mean, I had a few realizations. A, I should probably get a sponsor. I should probably work the steps. Those are the two things I really haven't done, along with maybe getting a home group and a service commitment. All the things that people will repeatedly say in AA meetings. I've done none of that. So that'd probably be a good start. And it was a miracle I didn't get kicked out of that treatment center, all the stuff that I was doing in there. It really was. I got in some trouble. I remember they kept people's cell phones in the office. I snuck in there and stole it. I snuck in there. I stole some instant coffee and sold instant coffee dollar bags. Cause we had one pot of coffee in the morning at 6 a.m. That was it. No more caffeine. The only time was at outside meetings we could get a cup of coffee. Gambled, whatever, but I had a good time to say the least. That was the kind of stuff I really enjoyed doing. Got me out of myself for a short period of time. And I had that same counselor and he told me to read the big book. And I wasn't sold. I was like, why? Like, why? Like, I always got to question everything. And he said, Alex, I know you. I think you need to do this. I think you need to go through the steps quickly rather than push it off. I think you need to have a spiritual experience. You need to read this book. And I said, all right, well, you know, whatever. And I guess it took me a couple days. I definitely didn't do it right away. Still to this day, I don't really do things that I should do right away. Takes a little bit. But I read the book. And in there is talking about, I remember in Bill's story, he's saying, now we're going to test this new God consciousness and do certain things. And it talked about praying for other people, praying for God's will. And my last day at the treatment center, I remember laying in my bed. And I had made the decision. I was like, I got the court. I have the court dates. They want me to do something, sober living, more treatment, whatever. And I believed it. I was like, I probably need to be in treatment longer. You know, I don't know any better. I don't know how I'm going to be able to stay sober. But this time I think I really want to do it. And I committed to go to Bel Air. There's like a little 90-day halfway house IOP program. And that's where they told me to go. My only question for them was, is it co-ed? Yeah, we're good to go. And I had a lot of ideas about how that was going to go down, but I ended up there. I ended up in Bel Air. And what happened from me leaving that treatment center in Virginia to me ended up at this halfway house in Bel Air was the first miracle I witnessed in my own life, as well as being my first day sober off of all the medications they had me on in that treatment center. It was my first day, was the day I left. And that night I remember laying in my bed saying, God, just give me knowledge of your will for me and the power to carry that out. And I knew every single step. You know, I knew what all the steps said from being in that treatment center. I have like a decent mind. I have a good memory, I like to think. And I memorized the steps so I could read them at our little morning meeting without looking at it, just, you know, to look cool. Or why I did that, that's probably why, I assume, so that people would think like I'm special. And so I said that prayer like it said on the 11th step. And the next day I had to go see my probation officer before I could go to Bel Air. And he told me, I violated you with good reason. And they took me from the courthouse down through the hallway, the long dark hallway, to the next building, the detention center. And I was sitting in the bookings. I asked him before, I said, what's going to happen? Am I getting out? Am I staying? Like, what's going on? He said, I don't know. You might have to be here until your next court date. This was January 6th of 2016. My next court date was March, maybe? March or April? I think it was March 10th, so a couple months. So I was, like, mentally preparing myself to be in jail for a couple months. As soon as I get upstairs to the cell block, I'm going to fill out an inmate request form so I can go to the kitchen like I was before and have a great time. And I went up to the court clerk. In Virginia, they call it a magistrate. And I said, like, what's going on? What are you guys going to do with me? And I think he told me to shut up or something like that. And he called my probation officer. And he asked him, he said, what do you want to do with this guy? And he said, I heard him through the phone. He said, he just completed 28-day treatment. Let him go. He's going to this other treatment center. And that's what they did. They let me out of jail that day on a PR bond again, personal recognizance. I signed my own name, agreed to show up at court, and I'm free. And I remember walking out of the jail. I'd been in there for probably an hour and a half since I went to go see my probation officer, no cell phone, anything. And I see my dad probably 200 yards away walking around the detention center on the other side, going back to his car, getting out of there. And I'm yelling at him like, yo! Come back. I was like, we're going. We're doing it. We're going to Bel Air. He's like, okay. I was like, we still got to stop, though, and get me that haircut. I had to get the fresh haircut before I went to Bel Air. Necessity. And I did that. It was really good. And I made it to Bel Air, and I was literally telling people, I was like, it's God's will for me to be here. But, like, the funny part is I actually believe it, and I still do today. It's, like, the corniest story I probably have. And I called my buddy who was in the treatment center with me, who was planning on coming up there too. I was like, you wouldn't believe what happened to me today. And I was like sold on it. I was like, that's real. Praying for God's will, praying for other people, it has to be real. Because I believe right now that this is God's will for me to be here. And that was like, you know, when I was really put on this path of recovery. And I could tell you, 2 weeks later, all I could think about was drinking, getting loaded, and I was in this halfway house, and that's all we ever talked about. And there was a guy there who was a member of my home group today, and we had a long conversation. I remember it was in the snow. He had a pack of Newports. I probably bummed five off of him. And we talked for probably 45 minutes or an hour, and the first thing I told him was like, look, I can't stop thinking about this all day, every single day. Like, it's all I think about. I think the only reason I made it there for a couple weeks was it really honestly had to be because of that spiritual experience, because it's proven to me in my past, fear has never been able to keep me sober. And I was there, and we talked. And this conversation, I don't remember most of it, but I remember the beginning when I told him I had this obsession, and he told me he had the same one too. And I asked him, he was probably about a year and a half sober, and I said, do you still have that sometimes? Where you just like, you gotta do it. Like, it's just getting you. And what he told me, it surprised me a little bit. He said, no, I don't. And what he said after that shocked me even more. to the point where I was almost speechless, beyond words. He said, "I help people and I love my life." And I was just like, "Dude, what are you talking about?" Like the way he carried himself, I respected it. I don't know why, but I did. And I just couldn't imagine. I couldn't imagine myself. Like the way he talked about himself, and I could relate to a little bit. I could see that. Like I got that. But the way that he talked about himself now in that given point in time, helping people, I was like, how? Like how do you do that? What do you even mean by that? Like, let alone like helping somebody have a spiritual experience. I couldn't imagine like helping somebody clean their room. Like I just couldn't. It wasn't a part of my mindset whatsoever. And it wasn't even for a couple more months when I actually did an inventory and started to have a real experience with the big book, when I realized I was completely incapable of putting another human being into consideration whatsoever. He went on to explain to me the big book and the steps and mechanics and everything about it. And just, we had a long talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had been, my home group now is one of the first meetings I went to in Bel Air. I got there on a Wednesday. I went the following Tuesday, and I heard a powerful speaker. And I think it's one of the main reasons why I still appreciate, you know, consistent speakers today, is when I hear them, it like moves me. A lot of the time, like I'll hear somebody talk and I might start to cry, or I might like feel chills, because like I can feel their experience and relate it to one of my own. And it was just so attractive to me. I can't put it into any other words, like how attractive Alcoholics Anonymous became to me. And I had this sponsor, and he's agreed to be my sponsor that Tuesday at that home group. And we started to go through the book, you know, read the first 63 pages, third step prayer. And we never really talked about writing an inventory. It was probably one of the things I was most scared to do, or maybe share that inventory. That's where the fear really was. And I didn't do it with him. I ended up getting another sponsor who was like sober for 20 years, looked good, sounded good. I heard him speak at a meeting. I was like, this guy's going to be my sponsor. And he was my sponsor for maybe a month, maybe two. And like we went to see a movie one time. That was it. And it's not to like knock that guy or say anything bad about him. That's just not the experience that I was supposed to have. And, or that I needed in order to progress. I do think it was a vital experience that I had with that man, because it was like, maybe what this guy does isn't what I'm supposed to be doing. And I was very lost at about 4 or 5 months sober when I heard my sponsor speak from a podium and talk about the big book and gave life to it, and talked about the insanity he had in his head about everything when he was sober. He went to the psych ward when he was 2 years sober. And just like the way that this man described himself to me, I could relate. And when he spoke from that podium, I was like, this is the guy. This is the guy who I want to ask to take me through the steps. And I saw him after the meeting, and I had met him before. He had greeted me at the door at my current home group many a times with a smile on his face. I went up to him after that meeting. I said, "Hey, man, thanks for sharing. Appreciate you. Can I get your phone number?" And that was it. I got his phone number. I called him back the same night. Said, "Hey, man, it's Alex. Like, would you take me through the steps, please?" And he's like, I don't remember exactly what he said. He probably said, "Absolutely." That's like his little catchphrase. It's kind of funny the way he says it. He's like, "Absolutely." And he did. And we didn't stop. We probably met up a few days later. We read the doctor's opinion, and he explained to me a little about alcoholism. And it talks about in there, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And it says a lot of things in there, and he kind of described his experience. He said, "Describe to me one of your experiences. Like, how can you relate to this?" And I just remember, like, looking on him like, yes, like, that's why I drink. And when I'm sober, I'm uncomfortable. And I think that drinking will fix that. And it does. And when I drink, I keep going. And I don't stop. And I usually experience consequences. And when I experience consequences, I get sober again. And then I'm going to do it. I'm going to stay sober this time. And what happens is, I'm sober and I'm miserable again. And I'm very uncomfortable in my own skin because I can't connect to anybody else. And I feel like I'm completely alone on this earth, no matter how much anybody, especially my mom, loves me. She's shown me unconditional love my entire life. She never left. She was always trying to help me no matter what. And I hurt her deeply. And it's something that will take the rest of my life to repair the damage that I've done right there. But the fact of the matter is, regardless, I will drink again. Unless I experience an entire psychic change from a spiritual experience that I have with God. You know, there's this guy. He's at this noon meeting every day. I don't go to the noon meeting as much as I used to. But he talks real passionately. And he talks about miracles. He says it's a miracle. It's something only God can do. And when I talk about God, I'm still not a religious guy today. When I think about God, I try not to attach any expectations, limitations, what God is, what God isn't. I just know that God's real and God has done for me the things which I could never accomplish by myself and change the entire way that I see another individual. Something that I'm just not capable. I'm not living up to like morals and standards by myself. Because naturally, I'll go the other route. I'll pursue what I think is going to make Alex feel great today. What's going to make me feel accomplished? How can I get ahead? And it doesn't matter about you. That usually doesn't look a lot like giving fully of myself for the well-being of another individual. It's just not what it is. And me and this guy, we went through the book. We did an inventory. I did an honest inventory with him. I told him the things that I wasn't going to tell anybody. Continued on and I started to make amends. I had an experience. My fifth step, it wasn't like blown out of the water, like burning bush moment. Like me and my buddy Matt were talking about that on the way up here. Kind of like I remember going home after I did this fifth step and really analyzing it, making sure that I was thorough as I needed to be. And I said that prayer, that seven-step prayer, and I went on a walk to 7-Eleven. This was like around the time when Pokemon Go was like a huge thing. So it was like late and there was just hundreds of people in the street. I was like, what's going on? I just walked to 7-Eleven, got like an aloe juice and just kind of like hung out. And I felt like at peace and at ease. And I really felt like I was ready. I was ready to live a life that was dedicated to God. And not to say that I didn't feel a powerful experience when I did that third step with that man, and I realized that my life was no longer mine, and it was something that I didn't deserve. It was something that I had to give to other people, and when that was kind of taught to me. But this is like when I felt like I was really ready to do that. And I went out and I started making amends. Not long after this, by the time I had gotten to this point and been ready to make amends, and we had started talking about practicing the principles like daily and talking about 10th step spot check inventories and nightly inventories and 11th step meditation and everything. When we started to talk about that was right around the same time I had also pled guilty to these charges. Finally, it admitted I was wrong, decided not to go to trial and beat this whole ridiculous case that I could never beat, and kind of saw like a little bit way out of that delusion. Of course, with the help of other people. And I just admitted I was wrong for the first time after being on that spiritual path. And then things kind of just worked out. I ended up going to court that September and had been through the steps, you know, I had worked and I had started and I had made some amends. And I went to court and I had sentencing that September. And I had saved up some money and I brought $4,500 with me, $3,500 for the guy for the restitution and the other $1,000 for the court costs and fees for my public defender. And I was ready. At that given point in time, I was ready to carry the message into jail if that was what was supposed to be for me. That was what was told to me. If you go to jail, it's because you're supposed to be there and carry this message to somebody else who might need it. And I was ready for that. And I remember going into that courtroom. I said a prayer on my knees on the stairwell. You know, the same one I'd been saying for the past 8, 9 months, whatever. God, please just give me knowledge of your will for me and the power to carry that out. It was as simple as that for me for a long time, because that was like the first prayer I ever believed worked. And I feel like I saw it work in my own life. And I went in this courtroom and the judge He gave me time. He gave me a year of probation and a 12 months with 11 suspended. He said, I think you should probably go to jail. After like everything the lawyer said, whatever, he didn't make a good case. He said, I think you should go to jail for a month since this guy had to sit in jail. But he didn't even know that I'd already been to jail for a few months. So I got time served and 1 year of probation. And I believed for these charges I had that I was probably going to do 6 months, maybe a year. I didn't know. Because this guy who I hurt, who got arrested, since he got arrested, there were no supposed guidelines. They could sentence me anywhere. It was like 0 to 15 years before the guidelines. It could be whatever. And I didn't know. I thought I would have to go back. And I didn't. And I got my probation transferred to Harford County, you know, did it, and it was the easiest thing I had ever done. Being somebody living a spiritual life, a law-abiding citizen, being on probation, it was nothing. You know, I actually sometimes look forward to going there because I had known a couple guys who had also been there who I had been able to try and help. And I got off the probation. I got my rights restored in Virginia from being a felony. The governor sent me a letter and got a bunch of stuff back. I got a car. You know, I used it. I started driving guys around, started trying to help people, and started trying to sponsor people. The first person I ever tried to sponsor, I was probably 8 months sober, maybe. It was around that same time period, and I had no idea what I was doing. All I knew was my own experience, and that was my sponsor reading the big book with me. So that was all I ever did with guys. And I read the big book so much with these guys, it's like I knew pretty much what it said and for a lot of the different parts. And nowadays, I still do that, you know, kind of 1, 2, and 3. I usually just talk about my own experience and kind of get down to that real understanding and try and start taking action as soon as possible. Because I know that's what really benefited my life when I started to take action, is when I really started to see things differently. But what I'm really trying to say is that I started getting a lot of things. I got a car, got some rights, got a great relationship with my family. Ended up a little while down the road, I got a girlfriend. We ended up getting our own apartment. I have an apartment now, same job I've had for 3 years. It's cool. I like it over there. I have some money saved up. You know, a bunch of great, great things. And I get to enjoy them. But that's not, and it's not an end all. It's not what it, that's not why I don't just like have them, enjoy them. In fact, those things bear no measure on the quality of my sobriety at all, because I've been miserable with those things: restless, irritable, discontent, uncomfortable, feeling lonely. And in the past, anything I've had like that worthwhile, I will give it up in 1 second for one drink to feel just a little bit of relief. But what I believe to be the truth about my life today is that the quality of my sobriety has nothing to do with all that stuff I got, how much time I've been sober, but really the way my relationship with God, am I relying on God? And more importantly, am I giving freely of myself regularly for the well-being of somebody else? Is that the truth of my experience? Is that what I'm doing right now today? And if the answer is yes, and usually it is, because I've found myself that I have to stay in the center of AA so I don't get kicked off when I'm on the edge, is that I'm all right. I get to enjoy my life. I get to witness the blessings in my life. And I see a lot of miracles happen with other people, but I think the greatest part of any spiritual awakening is being able to witness the spiritual experiences and growth in my life. And that I actually do have a purpose, and I can be beneficial to somebody else. And I'm not the piece of crap that I thought I once was. So if I could say anything relevant tonight, it's what I believe to be the truth, and that is that God has not let me down. I'm still standing here today. I believe I've let other people down. People may have let me down. But the only reason I think I'm still standing here today is because God has entered my heart and my life in a way which is indeed miraculous. Thank you for having me.